saw last week. Last week, we talked about universal structures of entanglement and correlations in many body ground states. That was just for the sake of learning about properties of ground states. We saw on Friday that we could learn a great deal about, say, universality class of a quantum phase transition or about a topologically ordered phase just by looking at how entanglement scales in those systems. Today, we will, from today, so for this week, we'll review another application of understanding the entanglement of structure of entanglement in ground states. And this will be the possibility of building an efficient representation of many body, of the ground state, or of the wave function of the ground state of a many body system. And so that's, today we'll start with the basics of this, but I've given you a couple of pages with a number of figures. And just as a way of summarizing what we will see this week, if you look at the first figure, there are drawings of this form. And then there is another drawing that looks more like, well, there is some hierarchical structure there. And then there is another one which looks like this one, but in two dimensions. And all these figures, what they represent are specific examples of tensor networks. There are a couple of copies left, I think. Are there copies left? If you could distribute them, please. And so by the end of the week, you should know what all these drawings mean and what the motivation for using that those particular structures, what the motivation is, and what it is that you can do with that. And that's how I want to start. I want to start by telling you what it is that we can do thanks to these tensor networks. I've listed four main points here. The first one is that tensor networks will give us a language or a formalism to efficiently describe ground states of local Hamiltonians. So what will happen, we'll see that instead of having to write exponentially many coefficients to describe a wave function, we'll be able to summarize the content, all the properties of this wave function in terms of a number of tensors, for instance, exploiting translation invariance or scale invariance in some context, a single tensor, or maybe two tensors, but a finite number of tensors full of complex coefficients will be enough to completely characterize the properties of the wave function. Okay? So it's a way to compress all the information that we need to know about the wave function into a small number of coefficients. Is that a question?
Yes.
So how does that more compressed? So this vector here, this would be a vector, right? With say, suppose that you have a d-level systems, say yeah. So d could be 2 for a spin 1/2 system, and then you have n of them. You would have d to the n coefficients. Okay. So this is a number that is exponential in n, and what we will see is that this number here. So this will be indeed some matrix or a tensor. The number of coefficients here will be some amount which is independent of n. So it's a constant. Okay? It's constant. So we go from exponential to constant. Or if we don't have translation invariance, maybe we'll go to order n. But that would be from exponential to linear. So we'll see that it indeed there is an advantage. But yeah, we'll see this. I'll start discussing this today. And we'll see during the week plenty of examples of that. OK, so the first thing is we have a language, a formalism to efficiently describe ground states. Is that blah, 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 or is it useful for anything? It turns out that it's very useful. And an example of result that has been obtained recently, thanks to having this formalism to even be able to talk about wave functions in a precise way, is a classification of gap phases of matter in the presence of a symmetry, the so-called classification of symmetry protected topological phases, gap phases. And that's something that we won't have time to discuss here. And maybe I'll have time to mention it again. But that's ongoing research for one-dimensional systems. Now it's a complete classification, so we know all possible phases of matter, gap phases of matter with a given symmetry. And this is something that happened in the last 2 years. And thanks to being able to describe these wave functions. Okay, so it is useful to have a language to efficiently describe wave functions. But this is purely theory. So the original motivation was another one for distance or networks, but that now that has turned into the natural language to use in order to talk about phases of matter. Okay, at least for gap phases of matter. What else? Why should we care about tensor networks? Well, the other thing is it provides us with insight into the structure of entanglement of correlations in a wave function. So as a matter of fact, these tensor networks are an expression of the structure of correlations and entanglement in the wave function. So it gives us a lot of insight. It tells us how to think about these wave functions. Okay, and maybe that at this point is just very abstract, but you'll see what I mean through examples. Okay. Third point, and that was the original motivation for tensor networks. They are a very powerful variational approach. So it gives you an explicit way of building a wave function. You don't know what the ground state of your system is, but now you have possibility of variationally optimizing all the tensors, all the coefficients in these tensors, and so that you minimize the expectation value of the energy. And then you have a variational class of wave functions. Okay, so this was the original motivation. If we're given a Hamiltonian, we would like to be able to talk about the properties of its ground state. Now we have a variational class of wave functions over which we can minimize the energy and assume that the wave function that minimizes this energy is a good approximation to the ground state. And it turns out that in problems such as interacting fermions in 2D, this variational class has become competitive. It beats all previous variational wave functions that we had for years and years. So in particular, variational Monte Carlo. So these tensor networks have become competitive with the best methods we used to have as in the domain of variational approaches. And finally, we'll mention this. It turns out that one of these tensor networks offers a non, it's also the basis for a non-perturbative formulation of the renormalization group in real space and also with holography. So this is interesting because in holography, in ADS CFT, you see all these derivations, but you don't really know what's a hypothesis. Well, they know what's a hypothesis and what it's not, but it's all very abstract. Here we will be able to realize it on a lattice. Okay, starting from a lattice Hamiltonian, we'll see how an emergent description of the system, a holographic description of the system emerges naturally. Okay, so these are, I believe, good reasons to care about tensor networks. And then what I'll do today is I'll start with the basics. And the first thing we have to do in order to deal, we'll be dealing with lots of tensors, and the usual notation for tensors, it's just not convenient. It's not very intuitive. So if you have matrices, you can use the usual notation, but when you have to deal with many, many tensors, that is just not affordable anymore. So the first thing we have to do is to introduce some diagrammatic notation or graphical notation for tensors. And that's not going to be very hard. I think you have in the second figure, you have examples. So what we will do is if we have a complex number, we'll just represent it with a circle. If we have a vector, represented with a circle with one leg. So this would be complex number, say C belonging to C. This would be a vector, V alpha. Okay. Then if we have a matrix, that would be Mij. So the idea is we'll represent indices by legs. Okay? So if I give you now a circle with, say, three legs, you automatically think, okay, I know what this is. This is a tensor with three indices, alpha, beta, and gamma. Okay? And so if you see something with many legs, you say, okay, that's a tensor, and I don't know, P with many indices. Okay? So far, so good. So that would be to represent the objects, the basic objects we'll be dealing with. And what about manipulations of these objects? So now we look at tensor multiplications. Let's call these tensors. So now tensor multiplications. So, and let's start with a simple example. If I give you this, what is this? Sorry? So, say a matrix then, right? So, yeah, a tensor with two indices. Yeah, clear? So, now, if I give you this, what is that? Come on. Everybody, at once. A vector, yeah. All right, so what we want to do now is we want to join two such objects, okay? That would be joining a vector and a matrix, okay? Now, the rule is that every time you see a leg that is connecting two circles, this is an index over which there is a sum, okay? So it's this index is contracted between the two. So if we want to represent this, this would be a matrix, say alpha, beta, and a vector, beta, okay? And implicitly, we have a sum over beta. Okay, and what is this equal to then? Has to be a vector, right? If you multiply matrix times a vector, you get another vector. So that's what we have here. V prime alpha equal to that. Okay? So at this point, you may wonder, well, what's the point of introducing this notation? We already had this one. We know how it works. Are we just trying to be original? But you'll see. You'll see. Well, maybe the example is have a look at now back at the first figure I gave you and try to write that as equation or as a contraction of, you know, 20 vector tensors. It's not so simple. Okay, so let's do a couple of examples to see how we go with this. What is this? Sorry? You're multiplying two matrices? Is that what you said? I couldn't hear. Product of two matrices. Do you all agree? So every time you see this, then this is indeed the product of two matrices. And you start seeing some pattern here. The final object, this is a very simple case of a tensor network. You have two tensors, okay, connected together. What you see is that the final object it has as many legs as the open legs on the left-hand side. Okay, so another example would be this. What is this? Somebody who have, yeah. That would be a complex number. No open legs, it has to be a number, right? So indeed, this is a number, and what does it correspond to? So that could be, for instance, as an example, could be the expectation value of sigma z, where this represents psi, this represents sigma z, and this represents psi again. So this is the ket, this is the bra. Okay? So if we wanted to represent the expectation value of an observable, we would take a vector times a metric representing the observable times the vector conjugate. All right, so I don't know, what else can we say? Let's look at this example. Somebody please tell me what this is. The trace? The trace of four matrices, perfect. So it's a number again, no open indices, that's trace of A, B, C, D, if this is A, B, C, and D, okay? So when you next time you see some drawing like this, now what do you have to do? You have to count open legs, and that's going to give you the number of indices of the final tensor. That was just a number here. That was a number here. That was a matrix here, and so on. All right. So for the rest of the week, we'll be using this notation. So let's define what a tensor network is then, at least a tensor network state or a tensor network in the context of representing many body states. So we'll assume that we have some lattice, which is made of sites with n sites. And each site, so V, will be the vector space of one site. And therefore, the vector space for the whole lattice is going to be nothing but V to the nth power, tensor power. Okay, that's again the many-body system we want to talk about. You can think of this V as just being just D-level system, so a complex vector space of dimension D. And what we want to do is we want to talk about a state of this lattice, and that's going to be that can always be expressed as a linear combination of a product basis and what we have here is this set of complex number or amplitudes, okay? And if I want to use the notation that we just described to represent this object here, what should I do? Dennis? How do we represent this object in the language of tensor networks?
In the same way as P.
Okay. So circle, because it's a tensor, right? With n indices, so n legs. Okay? So our goal is to find ways of efficiently describing this object. If we find an efficient way of describing this object, then we can efficiently represent this wave function. Question?
Could you represent more things if you have directionalities?
There is a context within tensor networks, there is a situation where you want to put directions. For instance, if you want to use symmetries, it will be important to understand how the symmetry is acting, whether it's the adjoint representation or not. Here we will not need that, but yeah, so arrows appear in a natural way here. It's just that for simplicity, we don't need them yet, so I won't be using them. Yes. But it gives you a sense of, for instance, if I draw a tensor like this, you can always regard a tensor as a linear map between the spaces that you have here. If you put arrows, you're telling me which indices correspond to incoming spaces and which indices correspond to outgoing spaces. So if I draw arrows, now you can think of this as a linear map between a tensor product of these two indices and into the tensor product of these two indices. So yeah, arrows play a role there. It's just that I'm not going to need them for this, at least today. OK? All right, so our goal is to represent these guys. And let me remind you that the big problem we have is that this object is very large, right? It contains d to the n coefficients. So if n is large, we don't know how to represent. We cannot store this in our computer. All right, and what we will do is we'll play the following trick. We'll replace this. We'll write this. We'll attempt to write a specific wave function of this form as a number of tensors connected into a network . This is the plan. That's what we want to do. We want to replace or be able to write all these coefficients in terms of a network of tensors, where we will assume that we have that this network depends only on a number of coefficients which only grows polynomially with n. Okay? And actually, in practice, it will only grow as, most of the time, it will only grow linearly in n. So I'll give you two examples of this. Yes?
So what is this? So it goes polynomially in general with n.
Well, we will be interested in the smallest possible growth in n. And we'll find, so it would be acceptable if it was polynomial, mm-hmm. in the sense that then it's already an efficient description according to what we understand as an efficient description, which is that it grows polynomial, mm-hmm. right, by definition. But in practice, we'll look at descriptions that only grow linearly in n, and in presence of, say, transitional invariants or some symmetries, we'll be able to reduce this to order one, so no growth in n. Okay.
But by description, you mean the amount of variables.
The number of the number of coefficients you have to give me to completely specify the state. Mm-hmm. Okay. So from there, we should be able to compute any of these amplitudes if we wanted to. Mm-hmm. Okay. Had a question?
The number of coefficients, so this other number of lines. How does it correspond to the number of lines?
Let me give you an example, and then maybe this will become clear. Okay. So the first example, you'll be very disappointed, because you know about it, and it doesn't even look like a tensor network. So imagine, remember, we talked about entanglement. Entangled state was one that could not be written as a product state. So let's consider first a product state, no entanglement at all. So how do we want to do this? It's just our wave function is going to be the product of n different wave functions, one for each side of the lattice. Okay? Now, let me be very pedantic and try to express this in terms of a tensor network to gain some intuition. So this would be the 2 to the n or d to the n coefficients that we have here. But now we realize that we can write them in terms of individual vectors for each side. And how do we write vectors, remember? In this way. Okay? So whenever we have a state without entanglement, we already have an example of what I'm trying to say here by writing the d to the n coefficients in terms of a number of coefficients which is linear in n. Why is this linear in n? Because each vector here only depends on d complex numbers. So we need to specify this vector, and so on. That takes, we have to specify, so strictly speaking, n times d complex coefficients, and we're done. Okay? And of course, this is a very restricted type of states. Is this clear? Yeah? So I'm saying, suppose that you only care about states that have no entanglement. Then automatically we have an efficient representation. Okay? It's a product state. You don't have to specify all these coefficients one by one. You can just say that these coefficients come from the product of the coefficients for each of the states. So in numbers, psi i1, i2, in is equal to phi 1, i1. That's a complex number times phi 2. Let me put this phi 1 component a1 times phi 2 component i2 times phi n component in. See? You give me n complex numbers, and I have the product gives me already this amplitude. Okay? So that's an example where with order n coefficients, we have completely specified d to the n coefficients, which result from multiplying all those guys together. Okay? So this would be the simplest possible example of a tensor network. Right? It's a tensor network where the tensors are not connected at all. And these tensors are very simple. They are just vectors. And remember, this is state without entanglement. And the key insight from last week is that we discovered that many body states, ground states of many body Hamiltonians, they are entangled. But they are not as entangled as a generic state. So what I mean by this is they were obeying this boundary law, or maybe logarithmic violations to the boundary law. But this is much, much less entanglement than if they were obeying this bulk law. Okay, remember that the entanglement entropy of a block was L to the d minus 1, perhaps with logarithmic corrections. And this is much, much smaller than the bulk law. Okay, so this is a radical case where there's no entanglement at all. We don't need to be so radical. We will see how we can incorporate entanglement into the wave function, but still retain a scaling that is much more favorable. So it will be, in general, typically it will be linear in N. Okay, so example number two is not going to be so disappointing, hopefully. Sorry?
I didn't follow.
Oh, sorry, D. This is the dimension of each side. Okay? So what we have is a system. This lattice system is made of sides which are D-level. And then you tensor product these guys. N times. And what I was saying is if the state of your system is a product state, then you have to specify what this vector is times this vector, but no, there are no correlations.
So for the polynomial n, do you mean the polynomial is for the each tensor or for the whole network?
For the whole network.
The whole network? Yes. So we can always use like only polynomial number of the tensor.
Right. So the number of tensors actually will typically be order n, linear in n, mm-hmm. And each tensor, the number of coefficients typically will not depend on n. And then you get order this situation here. But this is a statement about how many coefficients we need to specify the whole tensor network. Okay? Yeah. Excellent. All right, so example number two. And then this one is more for real. So you have, I think, in the second page that I gave you, there should be a drawing with the product state. Is there a product state? I should have taken a copy for myself. Let's see. Yeah, that's the product state. So now we have the second one. So in the second example, what we'll have is a quantum circuit. We'll start with state 0, 0, 0, product state on the top. We'll have n such systems. And then what we will do is we'll allow for quantum gates to act on pairs of adjacent systems in this way. Okay, and you want to think maybe n might be very large. At some point, we'll start thinking about n as being infinite. So this may go on. And the important thing is that this goes on for t different steps. So there are t different rows of gates. Now, I want to make sure that this is clear. This is not, I mean, this is describing a quantum computation. But we want to think about this as some classical calculation. So you start with some state here, and you apply these gates. Okay. So this, we didn't switch into quantum computing on a lab right now. Okay. So we'll use the same formalism, but what our goal is to obtain a classical description, a description in terms of numbers that you can store in your classical computer. Okay. So what I'm saying is that we start with a product state. We apply t rows of nearest neighbor gates. And the resulting state is going to be some entangled state. Okay, so we're going to use this construction, this quantum circuit, as a complete specification of this wave function. Okay, and if you look at this, this has the form of a tensor network. It's just a collection of tensors. You can think of these as vectors. And so on. And this is a tensor network description of the state that results from this quantum computation or quantum evolution described by a quantum circuit. OK. So in particular, how many gates do we have? Here we have order n times t. So the number of coefficients will grow as n times t times the number of coefficients that we have. So each gate. As for indices, if we assume that each index takes t values again, that's going to be d to the 4. Okay. So this is the number of coefficients that we store on each gate, in each gate. And this is the number of gates we have, n times t. Maybe n divided by 2, but we're not going to worry about this too. Is it clear? So the idea then is that if we take t to grow with n as a polynomial, then this is going to be an efficient description of many-body states. Okay? We just have to specify polynomially many coefficients, and we get a many-body state, or some highly entangled state of n sides. Is that clear? OK, so actually, any quantum computation can be written in this way. So we have to make sure that, I mean, it's not enough to be able to efficiently describe a state classically. We have to demand more things. And so I'm going to go through the list of things that we have to demand before we are happy with a given tensor network decomposition. So the checklist is as follows. That's 6.4 properties. What properties do we want to demand to a tensor network before we can think of this as a useful tensor network, one that we can use in practice to accomplish some of any of the goals that I described at the beginning. So the first thing we want is an efficient description. And this is something we had in the two examples we have seen so far, right? both for product state, where order n have parameters needed to be specified, or in this case, if t only grows as a polynomial as a power of n, then we have an efficient description in both cases. Okay? Efficient means that the number of coefficients grows as poly n, okay? A power of n. Okay. Second thing we want. This is not enough. If we just take this definition, then any quantum computation that can be done with polynomially many gates, which is in practice all useful quantum computations, would give rise to an efficient description. The important thing is whether we can also extract information from the resulting state. Right? Here we have completely specified state by giving this all these gates with polynomial poly n parameters. But can we compute anything? Do we know how much expectation value of an observable is on this state? In other words, we would like to know how much the energy of this state is, or how much the expectation value of sigma x is. We would like to be able to extract the properties of the state. So we want also to be able to efficiently compute properties such as we want to know how much the scalar product is, or how much the expectation value of a local observable is, etc. Okay? And we'll have to go through these two examples and see what that means. And finally, we don't care about tensor network just because we can use it. It has to be, has to represent a good approximation to the ground state that we're trying to represent with it. So it has to be a good approximation. To ground states. And for this, here we will ask specific questions. We would like it to be a good approximation to local expectation values. We would like it to reproduce the structure of entanglement in the ground state. We would like to look at structure correlations. So ideally, what we would like is that this variational ansatz, this tensor network, we would like it to be an exact representation of, say, the ground state of a given Hamiltonian. Okay? In practice, it will only be an approximation. It might be that it's just an approximation to the real ground state. But we would like it to be a very good approximation. We would like it to be an approximation that has that reproduces the same properties. So when we compute the expectation value of a local observable, we like to get the true exact value of this expectation value up to small corrections. Okay? And in general, I won't be able to argue here much about whether this tensor network gives you the right expectation value of local observables. That's something that you have to just try in practice, right? You have to use these variational wave functions and minimize the energy, and then see whether you get arbitrarily close to the exact solution if you have an exact solution available. Instead, but I won't do this. In this week, we won't see anything about numerical approaches. I'm just going to argue. We're going to look at the analytical structure of tensor networks. And in particular, we'll be able to say a lot about entanglement and correlations. Okay? We'll see, given a tensor network, whether it reproduces the scaling of entanglement that you would expect in a ground state. Does this tensor network automatically obey a boundary law or not? And we'll look at correlations. Do correlations naturally decay polynomially or exponentially, or would they not decay at all? So we'll be able to argue for the different, I think we'll look at three different tensor networks that are used. So the three that I drew in figure one, so the matrix product state, the MERA, and the PEPS, you'll see, we'll analyze how entanglement and correlations scale in them. Okay? There was a question.
Yeah, just trying to understand what you mean by efficient in B.
Right.
So I mean, if in A you already have a polynomial description,
yes,
of your state,
yes,
surely it means that your whatever it is you can count, you can also compute in polynomial.
We'll see that this is not the case. And we'll see it right now. Okay? Any other question?
You already made a good approximation. So what prevents us from it being exact?
Well, we would like it to be exact. Maybe there are small corrections. So this is, in some sense, tensor networks are a small entanglement or weak entanglement approximation. Mm-hmm. In the sense that you saw the starting point would be a product state where we don't repeat any entanglement, right? That is a very simple tensor network that we saw in the example number one. Now we're going to add the possibility of representing entanglement between the different parts of the system by adding legs between the tensors. But this remains a low entanglement approximation. It turns out that if your ground state is very entangled, we may be missing part of this entanglement. But it might be that this is the case, and yet we get already the right structure of the wave function, right? So it's think of this as a, I don't know, perturbative expansion where you get right the five first terms and you miss the rest. You're still missing something, but you get the essence.
Okay. Is it to do with the fact that these are specified sort of on real space, and so they might capture less the momentum?
This is always real space, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
We will be dealing with situations where momentum space is not even, we don't even know how to go to momentum space. It would be very complicated. It would, being able to go to momentum space would amount to solving the problem,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's useful to think about what happens in those cases where in momentum space your system can be dealt with in perturbation theory.
Mm-hmm.
But the key of tensor networks is that we are not in that regime. We are in a generic case, okay? So it's truly non-perturbative. We are trying to describe any possible ground state of any possible Hamiltonian in the strongly interacting regime, in the weakly interacting regime, anywhere. Okay, so Arthur asked why is B not automatically given when we have A, and let's see properties. Let's look at the properties. Property B. Or let's look at all the properties for the case where we have a product state. Example one. Let's go back to example one. We have room there. I'll just go back there. So property A, which is still there. Do we have an efficient description? We just said that. Yes, we have order n parameters. Okay. Now, can we efficiently compute expectation values? Say, can we efficiently first compute the norm or the expectation value of a local operator and so on? And the answer is, well, let's do it diagrammatically. But the answer is yes, because this expectation value is nothing but we write the ket, we write the bra, and we take the scalar product. And what you see here is this is a collection of numbers that are being multiplied. Remember, this tensor network has no open indices, so that's a number. And what we are saying is nothing more than the fact that in this case, this scalar product can be written as the product of n scalar products. Yeah?
Here it looks like each vertical figure is being added to the other vertical figures.
It's being multiplied.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yes? Okay. So we didn't discover anything new here. Now, so we can describe the wave function, we can compute the scalar product. Let's look at this one. So this one, what we would do would be that we insert some operators O in some, say, on the third side, if that's what we wanted. But again, you see that this is the product of individual pieces. And that just means something that we knew. Which is that if we're interested in just one side operator, then we compute it for that side, the expectation value for that side, and we keep adding the rest as before. And if this operator is acting on two sides, then we'll have to modify locally this part. But basically, it's always efficient. Okay? Any local operator can be efficiently, the expectation value of any local operator can be efficiently computed. Now, the big disappointment. The big disappointment comes when we try to think, OK, so we have property 1 and 2, or A and B, which means that we can efficiently specify the state, we can efficiently compute expectation values. But what is this useful for? Okay. Does a product state give you a good approximation to ground states? And I say disappointing, but it's not so disappointing. Actually, there is a whole level of approximation called mean field approximation, or mean field approach, that is based on assuming that your ground state looks like this, okay? No entanglement. And actually, you would be amazed how many thousands of papers are written using this approach. But the goal of tensor networks is to go beyond this approach, okay? So to go beyond mean field approximation. Why do I say that that's disappointing, though? If we look at entanglement, what do we see? We see that there is no entanglement. How do we see that? Well, the density matrix for the whole system is, we know that because this is a product state, but let's just exemplify it a little bit more. So what we find is that if we trace out a number of these systems, say we trace out this one and that one, the rest remains in a pure state. So the entropy as a function of L scales as zero. There is no entanglement entropy in the system. There is no entanglement in the system. And correlations is equally disappointing. If you look at the expectation value of an operator on, say, site O, expectation value of a two-point correlator on site 0 and site L, or site L and small l plus capital L, this would define our correlator as a function of L. And what we see, we want to subtract. So we want connected correlators. This defines our connected correlator, but this is equal to 0, OK? Every time you compute this part, you realize it factorizes into two pieces, which match exactly this part, and you get 0. So there are no correlations, there is no entanglement, nothing. OK? Instead, let's look at the other state. So the example number 2. The circuit, and then we already saw in example number 2 that we have an efficient description provided that T is only polynomial in N. But now we want to argue that we don't have, that in general we won't have an efficient computation. And that should answer Arthur's question. So let's look at property V for example number 2. And how do we compute the scalar product? Well, this is part of figure or something. You have it in, what's the number of the figure? That would be, should have kept a copy. So that would be figure 6.4b. So what we have is, we have psi. We would like to see how much this color product is. And when we try to compute it, we write first the ket and then the bra. The ket is of this form. And the bra is the joint of this tensor network, which we will draw by inverting everything. And the key is that if this is a quantum gate U, that's a unitary transformation, then this is the adjoint of it. Okay, so. And we have this property that I'm drawing as a circuit, which says that if you take U and U dagger, then you get the identity. That is nothing but saying that U is unitary. Okay? This expression here comes from unitarity of the gate. And I'm just drawing it. So let's say if we multiply U and U dagger, we get the identity. Okay? This is the identity on two sides. It is the identity there is no gate that is being applied on any of the sides. And so what this means is that when we compute this scalar product, then this gate and this gate get together, and so they can be replaced with identity. Let's do that. It's gone. Now the same applies to this pair. So it's gone. And now you go to the second row of gates here, and you realize, oh, this is some gate V. And this is it's a joint, so it's going to disappear too. And you do that pairwise, and you're left with identity everywhere in the circuit. OK? Is that clear? You have a quantum circuit. It's complex conjugate, of course. It's a unitary process that you are undoing, so you get with you end up with identity. And that's now just a product state, a scalar product of a product state. 0 times 0 gives you a 1. Every single line gives you a 1. And so we know that the scalar product is equal to 1. Now, at this point, drawing gets too tiring. So that was the point of giving you all these slides. So this is what I just described, right? The scalar product of this state that we are encoding in a quantum circuit. By construction, all these gates are unitary, and they annihilate each other. You get you the identity, and then it allows you to remove all these gates row by row, and you get this, which means it's a very simple quantum circuit where you start with state 0, and you end up with state 0, and this happens with probability 1. So we get 1. Good. Now, let's try to compute the expectation value of a local observable on some site in the middle. Okay, and this is represented here. Again, the upper half of this figure represents psi as a ket. The lower half is the ket, so psi and psi. That's this expression here. And this circle here is, say, sigma x, or some local observable that you want to, for which you want to compute the expectation value. Okay? And now we're going to use again that U and U dagger, say, this is gate U, this is U dagger, they will annihilate each other. And you can play this trick, except that here, everywhere, so for instance, all these gates will disappear with those. But what about this one? This one, we cannot apply the condition. There is something in between. So it's not u times u dagger. It's u times something times u dagger. We don't have a rule to eliminate that. So we have to keep it. So all this for rho goes away, except for these two gates and the dot, the blue dot. Now, once we've removed all these gates, we realize that we can, again, remove gates on the second row and third row and so on. But there are some gates that cannot be removed, right? Because there is an obstruction. This is u, u dagger, but there is something in between. This is v and v dagger, but there is something in between. So we cannot remove these gates. And so if we want to compute this expectation value, say expectation value of sigma z, then we still have to contract this tensor network. It has simplified a lot, but not completely. Okay? And what is this?
Cancel.
And so once we realize this is, these lines can be removed, there is nothing there, they give you number one to multiply the rest of the expression. And whenever, you know that whenever you have a matrix, say I give you a matrix, it's ij, and you have all these elements. If I say I is equal to 1, right? If I put explicitly a 1 here, if I fix the value of one index, that means, what does this mean? 1, it means that we are on this, on the first row. So what that means is that now, if I take M, matrix M, and I fix this, this is like a vector, right? We're left with a vector. So every time we fix an index in a tensor, we end up with a vector, with a tensor with one index less. So what I'm doing here is I'm saying, look, this is a tensor with four indices, but I'm fixing the incoming indices here to zero. So I remove those indices, okay? Just the same way that when you have a matrix and you specify first column, you get a vector. So when you have four indices, but you specify two of them, then you end up with a tensor with just two indices. And this is the tensor that we have to compute, the tensor network that we have to compute if we want to find the expectation value. And it turns out that when we try to do that, there is a cost. So a way to understand, so if you try to multiply these tensors together, you'll have to follow some order, some pattern. Maybe you want to multiply this times this first, and then this and that. There is a cost. And the cost of doing this turns out to be exponential in the number of tensors that you see here, in this case, 4. But if t was, so the idea is that we have found this figure, something like this. Where we have many tensors here. And the important observation is that the number of tensors that we have in a given row is at most 2 times t. Remember t? T was the number of rows in the depth of the quantum circuit, how many rows of unitaries we have. And there are t of them. And then we obtain this structure here. We're going to call this the past causal cone of this point. You can see maybe why this is called the past causal cone. You could think, remember that this is a quantum computation. The stick is going to be useful. So remember, by construction, this is the ket. And time, you could think that there is a time going downwards until here, which transforms the states, a product state 0, 0, 0, into an entangled state. And we are asking, what gates in the quantum circuit can influence this point? And this is given by all the gates that we cannot remove when we look at this point. These are exactly these gates. So we call this part of the circuit the past causal cone of this point here. Okay? And the idea is that the width of the causal cone, so this is the causal cone, and it has a width. And this width, how many gates we have, say, at the top, how many gates we have here at the top, this is the width, and it goes as 2t. Okay? You can see that it's twice t, divided by 2 in this case. Well, the number of legs that we have is 2t, so where t is the number of rows here. Okay? So the conclusion is that there are 2t or order t gates in this direction. And it turns out that the cost, you can try, and you'll be thinking about this during the tutorial today. You can try to think about what's the cost of computing, multiplying all these indices. Mm-hmm. Yes, Dennis?
What is the exact definition of the computational cost?
OK.
Because it's important.
What's the definition of finishing the class too late? 1 minute?
Yeah.
OK, so if we have a matrix, remember this is a matrix, right? We're going to assume that this index here, I, can take a number of values. This index goes from 1 to d1. This index j can go from 1 to d2. Okay. And imagine that we have another matrix, which has the first index is j, and the second index is k. We can ask, what's the computational cost of performing this matrix multiplication? So this is a. This is B. This gives rise to C. And the question is, how does the cost of multiplying these two matrices scale with the dimension of the indices? Okay? With the size of these indices, the size being D1, D2, and D3. And to answer this question, well, we may temporarily go back to the usual standard notation. We have I, J, J, K, going into C, I, K, and we're adding half a sum over J. And we ask, how many operations, basic operations, do we have to perform? And how does this number scale with the size of the index?
But what do you mean by basic operations? Addition, subtraction, multiplication?
It will be something that we can relate to. So something that does not depend anymore on the size of the index. Some basic unit. You can choose the unit, but it has to be a unit that does not depend on the size of the indices. Uh-huh. To be very, very concrete, we'll look at how many additions or multiplications we have to perform. Okay, multiplications of two complex numbers. Mm-hmm. And so let's look at this. What we see is that for each value of I and K, okay, so this is going to be for each value of I and for each value of K, and how many values of I do we have? We have D1 values here and D3 values there. For each value of I and J, we'll have to come here and make multiplication and add something which depends on J. And so how many values of J? D2. Okay. So the cost is, for each value of I and J, perform D2 basic multiplications. You have to multiply two numbers and add them together to what you had already. So this means we have D2 basic steps, basic operations, for each value of I and J. And we have to do this D1 times and D2 times, right? For all values of I and J.
But you must do also then D2 addition, or better to say D2 minus 1 additions.
Yes. Some number of additions.
Yes, some number of additions. D2 multiplications plus some additions.
Right. So D2 multiplications and additions. Order D2. So we have to do, we have a multiplication and an addition, D2 times. Mm-hmm. Right? Yes? So, and we have to do this for each value of I and for each value of K. For each value of K. So the total cost scales. So suppose that we now take J, and instead of going from 1 to D2, it goes from 1 to twice D2. Then we'll have to do twice as many operations. Okay, that's the point, that the cost scales linearly in D2.
Well, I simply thought that it will be a D2 squared because,
Okay, so the cost is linear in D1, but it's also linear in D2 and in D3. Mm-hmm. And the cost is actually the product of these three. the 1 times the 2 times the 3. And so when we have this matrix multiplication, we'll say the cost scales as the product of the size of all the indices involved. Okay? So in general, if you have asked the question how much, if they ask you how much is the multiplication of an m times n matrix with another m times n matrix, the answer is the cost of multiplying them together is m to the 3. Okay? That's, if you now go to Mathematica or MATLAB and you try to multiply matrices and you see the time that it takes as a function of the size of the matrix, it's going to be the third power of the linear dimension. OK, so time is up, as usual. But as usual, I'm going to try to push it. So what I wanted to say then is that we see that these ansatz, that the cost of computing this expectation value, well, believe me, the cost, and you will believe me even more after the tutorial this evening or this afternoon, that the cost is exponential in the width of the causal cone. Okay? It's cost goes exponential in width of causal cone. It's exponential. And so this means that we could efficiently represent this wave function. We could happily represent this wave function when t, we have seen that t only needed to be polynomial in n. But the cost that comes here now, the cost is exponential. When we try to compute observables, the cost becomes exponential in t, in the depth of the quantum circuit. Okay? So you have this wave function, you specify it completely, but when you try to ask how much is any observable, you have to compute for a time which is exponential in the width of the quantum circuit. And so that's okay then only if t is logarithmic, if the width, the depth of the quantum circuit is logarithmic in n. But what we see is that this second example is only efficient if the depth of the quantum circuit, the number of rows that we have, is small, is only logarithmic in the number of sides in the lattice. Okay? And I'll have to stop here.